Right. Good morning. That was sweet. I came across the video clip of the young people singing at the Parliament building yesterday. And there's something, I'll do a message later on motherhood. I was going to do that today, but I realized that the more I looked into it, that the more that I couldn't do it justice to the time that I had to prepare. So I had started a message on honoring mothers, and I want to do it next time or shortly, next time I preach, I guess, but not today. But as I was looking at that video clip of the young people singing and looking at you all up here and the children singing, there's something about that that is so utterly, deeply righteous that it touches me in ways that I can't express. The young people singing at the Parliament building, for example, they're clear-eyed, they're there with their moms, they've chosen to sing, they're testifying of God, it's harmony, it's obviously practiced. There's a lot of time that went in, it's unashamed, there's an identity, togetherness, clearness of conscience. There's just something so deeply, deeply righteous about that video clip. One thing that I have often thought about us as people is I wish we could be more visible. I wish people could see what God's people look like. And it's not self-righteousness. It's simply saying this is how God's people are and what God's ways look like. It's not us. We're simply doing what God asks us to. And then with that comes tremendous blessing. And this was part of it today. Thank you for that. Thank you for singing. So again, I'm not doing a Mother's Day message. I would have liked to, really, but to be fair, again, I couldn't do justice to what I needed to say. But I would like to read a few quotes that I came across. Thinking of motherhood and what society has done with a woman being at home and the level of respect it gets or doesn't get, the value that society puts on it, and the value that God puts on it are North and South Pole. They're totally different, but a few things here that I'd like to read. Let me quick read it. Just a few poems that I came across. And this one here, thinking of the working woman. Again, maybe an executive, maybe making more money than her husband. Worked her way up, went through college, university, worked her way up the corporate chain, and she's successful, and maybe she's an executive. And maybe she has children. And that, to some, is success. But on the other hand, listen to this. And this puts it really well. This is a child talking to someone else. You may have tangible wealth untold, caskets of jewels and coffers of gold. But richer than I, you could never be. I had a mother who read to me. Oh, I like that. You may have tangible wealth untold, caskets of jewels and coffers of gold, but richer than I you can never be, for I had a mother who read to me. So, so true for what the world needs. And one more before I go to my message. I had a mother's influence. These are anonymous. I don't know. The writers aren't known, so I don't know. I can't quote the author. But a mother's influence. Just two short verses here. I took a piece of plastic clay and idly fashioned it one day. And as my fingers pressed it still, it moved and yielded to my will. I came again when days were past. The bit of clay was hard at last, and the form I gave it, still it bore, but I could change that form no more. I took a piece of living clay and touched it gently day by day, and molded with my power and art a young child's soft and yielding heart. I came again. When years were gone, it was a man I looked upon. That early impress still he wore, and I could change that form no more. Anonymous writer. So moms, that's you. You have lives that you mold and shape and make into something that will bear it eternally. It's the deepest, most important, vital, critical, put all the words in that you want, job on the planet by far. There's nothing else that's close to that. Nothing. So I'd like to honor mothers on a different message. I'm looking forward to it. You have a critical part in the world that is so unappreciated often or unnoticed. But what I'd like to talk about today is Balaam. It's something I preached surprisingly. I thought it was more recent, but it's 2016 when I shared on this. There's Balaam's name comes up often in the Bible. I think it's in like 6 or 8 different books in the Old and New Testament. And it's referencing him in certain ways that are shocking when you look at them. But in reading the story, I know when I first read it, I had a big question mark that came to mind reading it. Like, what is this? What is actually happening? There seemed to be contradictions. Who was he? Was he good? Was he bad? What was he? What on earth happened? So I'd like to simply look at that. Balaam, who was he? And then maybe two of the underlying themes in his life and the errors. And when the Bible talks about him, what are they saying? And the verses that come up in Jude, Revelations, Numbers, Hebrews. I think it's Deuteronomy. I think it's Psalms. Numbers a number of times later on after the story. So there's many references to him. What are they talking about when they reference Balaam? I'd like that to be clear when we're done. So we do know the story, I'm assuming. The donkey that talked is the main takeaway for most people going through it. So we know the story. Was he good and had a bad end? Was he bad all the way through and the beginning was a fluke? Or what was that? Why did he keep asking God to curse Israel? A very odd thing. What did he actually do? Where and how did he die? And what were the fruit and consequences of his actions? So those are things that we'll be looking at in the story as we go through it. And I would simply like to do that, to go through the story. I'll be reading it in skimming once. And then going back and just looking at the story again, but with commentary from the rest of the Bible. So when Revelations references him, when other places reference the donkey incident, I'd like to go to the other places and give that light to it. But that'll make sense as we go through. So if you have your Bible, go to Numbers 21. It'd be really helpful to read along if you have one. So if you have one, go there. Numbers 21, 22 is where it starts, but we'll pray and go into that. So God, we come to you this morning. I pray from your word that we can learn how to be and how to not be. And what you find critical, how you think about things. We want your heart on money, on truth, on respect for God, on listening, on obedience, on a heart tuned to you, on honoring you. God, teach us these things today as we look at the life of Balaam and the awful error that he had. Pray we can apply it to our life. God, speak to us that we can be convicted, but not condemned, but guided in the right way and set our hearts firmly towards God in a real way, that our lives can be pure and true and right and have good and godly fruit that you would have for us. Speak to us this morning from this portion of your word that you've put in and in different places through the Bible, that we can learn what you would have for us as you placed it there. We give this rest of the morning to you with thanksgiving. Amen. So Numbers 21, starting in, I think, 21. So this is right after the incident with the snakes, when they got bitten, the children of Israel. That is in verse 21. And Moses set the serpent on a pole, and they got healed by looking at it. This is right after that incident, as they're journeying through the through wilderness, essentially. And they're moving from, I almost wish I had a map up, but I don't. That projector would be great sometimes. But I like to know when I read the names, where are they going to? Where are they in the geographical location? Where are they going to? Where are they coming from? Where is this? What's happening? So they're moving from north to south. They're moving. They went from Egypt. They went to quite a bit south into the, I think it's the Sinai Peninsula. And then they started traveling north and moved up all the way past Jericho. but I can't go there. But yeah, they're going north on the east side of the Dead Sea, if you do have access to a map, where Amnon and Moab bordered each other. There's different regions, different kings that had control. And we're dealing with Ammon and Moab at this point. They're bordering. They're hostile to each other. They've got a strong border between them. And Ammon had taken all of Moab's land earlier. A king before the one we're reading about had gone in and taken Moab's land. And either he didn't take the total thing or he got some of it back. But they had a war that Ammon had won. So Numbers 21. But the whole story started this way. They're moving up. Where can I break in? I'll just start in 20. And they moved from Bamoth in the valley, that is the country of Moab, to the top of Pisgah, which looked towards Jeshimon. And so Pisgah is where they saw for the first time saw the promised land, where God said, "This is yours. This will be your home. This is what I had in mind when you first set out. This is what I promised Abraham. This is your land." Pisgah was that spot, so they're now right close. And Israel sent messengers unto Sihon, king of Amorites, saying, "Let me pass through thy land. We will not turn unto the fields, into the vineyards. We will not drink of the waters of the well, but we will go along the king's highway until we pass by thy border." So we'll make it as easy as possible. We are coming. We have 1 million plus 2 million people. But all we want to do is go through. We're not going to drink. We're not going to pillage. We're not going to anything. We'll stay literally on the road as we go through. A very reasonable request. But Sihon would not suffer Israel to pass through his border. And Sihon gathered all his people together and went out against Israel in the wilderness. And he came to Jahaz and fought against Israel. And Israel smote him with the edge of the sword and possessed his land from Arnon unto Jabbok, even unto the children of Amnon. For the border of the children of Amnon was strong. So basically they said, "Can we go through?" He said, "Absolutely not." He brought his whole army there and said, "No way are you passing." They actually initiated war. Israelites won decisively. And moving forward, then the king of Amnon was actually stronger. No, sorry, the king of Sihon, who they just defeated, had previously defeated Ammon. Sorry, I'm not sure what my voice is doing. I apologize. So they're now afraid because they're wanting to, they're now right next door, essentially, and they're fearing. And so now Moab is looking at this situation that a strong king came against these newcomers and lost decisively, and Moab is now terrified. These people came in and took out the stronger king. They're stronger than we were. And Moab is now in panic mode. And then this story initiates. And Balak, in chapter 22, Balak the son of Zippor saw that all Israel had done to the Amorites, and Moab was sore afraid of the people because there were many, and Moab was distressed because of the children of Israel. Chapter 22:3. And Moab said unto the elders of Midian, "Now shall this country lick up all that are round about us, as the ox licks up the grass of the field." And Balak, the son of Zippor, was king of the Moabites at the time. He sent messengers, therefore, to Balaam, the son of Beor, to Pethor, which is by the river of the land of the children of the people, to call him, saying, "Behold, there's a people coming out." And for sake of time, I'm not going to read that. So he's calling for Balaam to come work for him and go against the children of Israel. I'm not sure how much to read or not read here, but they came with they came there. They asked him to come. Verse 8, he said unto them, "Lodge here this night, I will bring you word." And God said unto Balaam, "What are these men with thee?" And Balaam said unto God, "Balak the son of Zippor, king of Moab, has sent me, saying, 'Behold, there's people coming out of Egypt to cover the face of the earth. Come now, curse them, and I want to overcome them and drive them out.'" So this here is the key verse in the whole, like in the whole story, this is the key verse. "And God said unto Balaam," pay attention to this, "God said unto Balaam, 'Thou shalt not go with them. Thou shalt not curse the people. They are blessed.'" And I wish I could put that on the board and just leave that right there. This is what God said: "Thou shalt not go with them." There's no other way to slice that except "thou shalt not go with them." This is God speaking. Thou shalt not go with them. Thou shalt not curse the people, for they are blessed. And Balaam rose up in the morning and said unto the princes of Balak, go back to your land, basically, for the Lord refused to let me go. He's not letting me. That's a very odd response. And the princes of Moab rose up and went to Balak. They went back home and saying, he's not coming. And Balak sent yet again to the princes, more honorable, more money, more power. And they came and said, what's let nothing stop you? You need to come with us. 17, I will promote you. I will give you whatever you want. And Balaam answered and said to the servants of Balak, if Balak could give me his house full of silver and gold, I cannot go beyond the word of the Lord my God to do less or more. And this is where it gets confusing, that this man is talking like this. So it's almost like when you read it, you can get confused with what's going on because he's saying the right things. If God would give me the house full of silver and gold, I cannot go beyond the word of the Lord my God to do less or more. That sounds like a very good, upright, almost an Isaiah-like statement or Jeremiah. So the respect for him tends to go up at times like this. But then he says, now therefore I pray you, tarry here also this night, that I may know what the Lord will say to me more. So he's going back to God. And then in verse 20, if the men come to thee, rise up and go with them. So Balaam rose in the morning, took his ass, went with the princes of Moab, and God's anger was kindled because he went. And the angel of the Lord stood in the way. We have the donkey talking incident where the angel was there and would have killed him. The angel of the Lord reveals himself. He talks to the angel. At the end of that, he's still going. He's saying, hey, if you don't want me to go, I can turn back. Where are we here? He said, the angel says, go with the men, but only the word that I shall speak unto thee shalt thou speak. And Balaam went with the princes of Balak. They went unto the city of Moab, then tried to curse them. So I think because we know the story, for sake of time, because it's so long, I think I'll just leave it there and start going through it with the commentary that the Bible gives it. So yeah, again, I hope we're familiar enough to do that. So they're moving, the Israelites are moving in. They took over one region. The other region was terrified. He called them over and said, come, help us. So as we look at the Bible's commentary, it's very, very clear what's going on. From reading the story, it's hard to get. So where am I here? Sorry for being scattered. Okay, so again, verse 12, I want to say that again. God said unto Balaam, thou shalt not go with them, thou shalt not curse the people, for they are blessed. And his response there, just going into the commentary, is basically, God won't let me. So I'd like to, I understand your position, but sorry, not allowed. And with that comes, I think, a reluctance to, or a disappointment. But here's a man, if you think of what he's saying, here's a man who speaks to and hears from God, like legitimately. Like none of us have this. We don't go intercede and get answers and talk directly to God. So how this worked, I don't know. I've often wondered, how did God talk to the Old Testament prophets, Jeremiah, Isaiah, direct revelation, lie in your side for 40 days and like specifically or go to the brook and be there and like he talked to them. So here's a man who speaks to and hears from God. He's obviously used to it. Like this is normal for him by the language that's here. He knows God. He has access to God. Some say he was always a false prophet, but I don't think that's the case at all. And some say this was an exception, this incident. So I don't think God would have opened heaven to a false prophet and just talked to him that way. So I think he was a prophet that knew God, that talked to him, that understand what it meant to obey him. He knew the heart of God. He knew how God was. In 2 Peter, just going to commentary of what the Bible says about the situation, 2 Peter, it says, which have forsaken the right way, it's talking about false prophets, and have gone astray following the way of Balaam. So he's like the proverb here, who love the wages of unrighteousness. But the language here, they have forsaken. So they were here, they went over there, they've forsaken. They were on the right way, they forsook it, they are gone astray, they were on the right path, they're now straying, and they follow the way of Balaam. So Balaam here, according to 2 Peter, was right and departed from that way. In Jude, again, different takes on this situation here. Jude, there's again a book of warning. It says, the angels was kept not their first estate, but left their own habitation. So angels which were right, but they departed with Satan. And he has reserved an everlasting chains unto darkness. And then as Sodom and Gomorrah and cities about them in like manner, he said, giving them over. So it seems that Sodom and Gomorrah were at one point also not wicked, but they got there to fornication and then going after. So they were here and they're now going after strange flesh. They're set forth an example, suffering the vengeance of eternal fire. So going down through that warning section, he's saying, woe to them, for they have gone the way of Cain. They ran greedily after the error of Balaam. So Balaam, according to these texts, was a man of God and then departed severely, according to Jude and Peter. Second Peter says he loved the wages of sin. And look at Numbers 22:7. It says, the elders of Moab and the elders of Midian departed with the rewards of divination. Like, we don't read of them coming to Isaiah with money and saying, hey, would you do this for us? We need you to curse God's enemies. But somehow, the people in the neighboring land knew something about him, that they came with money to give to the prophet for his revelation. Divining would be to open things not seen in their hands. So they came prepared. Now, what his reputation was, I don't know. But it's very odd that they know that they do that they would initiate wealth or collect wealth and take it and go to a prophet of God. Like, who was this man? What reputation did he have? It's a very odd situation. So was that how he made a living? I don't know. Was it a gift of honor that they came with tribute? Was it an obvious bribe, as simple as that? I don't know. But it says Balaam loved the wages and turned his heart to them. In verse 16, they say to him, basically, let nothing, I pray thee, hinder thee from coming to me. He's basically saying, name your price. So we're in conversation. He's now said, God won't let me. And now they're saying, okay, now we're talking. Name your price. Like, what do you want? Again, for a prophet of God, that's odd language. In verse 19, going back to what I said before, what did God say? God said, do not go with them. Do not curse them. They are blessed. And so when Balaam goes back to God the second time, what's he asking for? Like, have you ever thought, what would he have liked to hear God say? Go curse my people? Like, what was he thinking? What's he asking for? He's saying, I'm going to go ask God a second time. Because God had said, don't go, don't curse them, they're blessed. What more should God reveal? Should he reveal how for sure he should not go? Like, how deeply could we mine that out? Or how blessed are they? What was he wanting from the clear thing that he got? Why is he going? So he's now pressing God for more revelation. and the end, God does say, and God said unto Balaam at night and said to him, if the men come to call thee, rise up and go with them. So what? Now what? So God does say, go ahead. But as we read later, it becomes very clear what this was. And I envision it this way. If maybe my boys would ask me for a drone, they want to buy a drone for $1,000. And we've always had a thing about toys and spending money there. So if they would come to me and saying, I want to buy a drone for $1,000, they know already what I'm thinking. We've had this like 20 years. And I would say, of course not. We're not spending $1,000 money on a drone. Like, you know that. And I give that answer. And then he comes to me later and says, hey, it's on sale a week later. It's like 25% off. Can I get it? We had one where it's been long established of what's going on. God's people will not be cursed. Why is a prophet of God entering that territory? And two, we got a clear answer. We're not buying the drone, and do not curse them. Do not go. It's clear. So why the third endeavor with that? And if he comes to me a third time and saying, hey, the sale ends tomorrow. I'm going past this door. Can I get it? And if I at that point say, buy it. What just happened? Did I change my 20-year viewpoint on it? Did I backtrack from my first and second one? Nothing. I didn't move one inch from what I meant and what I said. I disconnected. You can do what you want, but will my blessing be there? Never. But if you're determined to do what you want, like, go for it. But it's not connected to me anymore. It's like, go. But not with me. I'm not entering it. I never will. So there's a disconnect. Go if you want to go. And buy it if you want to buy it. I'm not fighting you. Like, respect me enough to take what I'm giving you. And on that basis, we can operate. But if we're fighting and pushing each other, it's a non-starter. We don't play with me. So as a dad could say, go buy it. But again, I'm not agreeing. That's the point here. So when God said, go. And later on, it'll be very clear that that is what happened. I'm not just reading into it. So he does go. And so it's like God is saying in his heart, and God is seeing his heart and is saying, I told him my answer. If you want to go, go. Nothing will change. I'd said, don't go. I said, they're blessed. Don't curse them. That's established. God said it. And yet he's pushing and pushing and pushing. And then he heads out, and it's very serious to push against clear light, and that's obviously what he's doing. And the angel says, had your donkey, or he's the donkey incident, where the donkey hurt him, he beat it, he was going to kill it, and then the donkey sits down in the middle of the road, and then the angel is revealed. He talks to the donkey like he's extremely upset. I think I'd be shocked if my donkey, if I had one, would talk to me. But he answers it back, like, it's just weird. And I'll read in verse 34 if you have a Bible. And the angel of the Lord said unto him, wherefore hast thou smitten thine ass these three times? Behold, I went out to withstand thee. And this is why the donkey was there, because thy way is perverse before me. So this is what God thinks. When God said, go, this is what God thought of it. Your way is perverse before me. So when God said, go, it wasn't a, hey, we can work with this situation. Go, I'll put good words in your mouth. God was not happy that he went. He said, your way is perverse. The fact that you went after asking me three times is an awful thing. What are you doing? It is perverse that you're on this road. I almost killed you because of what you're doing. This isn't light. So the blessing of God is not with this man. So after all of this, he knows what God's heart would be. He asked him three times. God said, then go. While he's going, he has this fight with his donkey. The angel tells him, you were this close to being dead. I almost smote you. Your way is perverse before me. That's why I'm here. And what is his response now in verse 34? I cannot believe this guy. Except I'm not saying this to mine out how awful he was. There's a sub-point here that something got into his brain and polluted it. And that something applies to everybody. And it's the deceitfulness of riches. The Bible talks about it often. Somebody should do a message on that. But you can have clear, rational people that operate fully functional, but have this bizarre view. The off-the-wall ones would be Benny Hinn with his Holy Ghost machine gun, wanting to mow down those that come against him in his wealth, prosperity. Others of the prosperity teachers would be, God wants you to be filthy, stinking, something rich. Like, those quotes are way out there, but I'm not necessarily talking about them either. There's something about money that can almost diseased the brain, if I can put it that hard. But clear, functioning people, in other words, not mentally addled, but they do things and say things that from the outside can make no sense whatsoever. And how far that trickles into the Christian's life and our life and our church life, I don't know. But there's something awfully deceptive about money. Extremely so. Enough so that the Bible mentions it numerous times, the deceptiveness of riches. So this man has a severe case. I get that. And again, my point isn't to say how awful he was. I'm just saying this is something that's to be noticed and warned about. So if somebody's going after money, you are probably part of that fog or swirl. It's something that is not safe. So, but to show how much this man had it, the angel said, your way is perverse before me. And Balaam's response is this. You know what? I can go back if you don't want me to go. That is unbelievable. Balaam, three times when God said no, he reluctantly did it. Your donkey had this situation. The angel of the Lord with a sword stood in front of you and said, your way is perverse before me. And he's still pushing. He's saying, hey, if you don't want me to go, I can turn back. It is unbelievable, Balaam. And because he's still pushing, the angel now says, go. Did the angel want him to go? What was the angel's response? One verse up. The angel's response, or the angel's take on it, one verse up said, it's perverse. And then he's saying, I would still love to go. Do you think we can maybe find a loophole here? Push, push, push. And the angel says, go. But we know what God's heart is when he said go. We know what the angel's heart is when he said go. And Balaam is still going. So, again, I want to bring out the deceitfulness of riches is a... So we look at this from a removed point of view, but the deceitfulness of riches is a big thing. Even though this, I hope, I mean, obviously, this is an extreme case. So he's continuing. If it displease thee, I can turn back. Well, it's pretty clear if it displeased him or not, but he's still going. So he's again gets the okay to go, but God will absolutely use this as a tool. If you're going, we are going to work with this. We're not going to have you curse them. So Balaam went. Again, with a do not go, do not, that's all still there. What God initially said, it has not changed one millimeter. I'm going to 2 Peter again to look at that, what it said about him. 2 Peter 2:16, if you have a Bible. So what does the rest of the Bible say about this incident? So when we read the story, it can be hard to figure out, but as you read the other passages, it becomes really clear. So 2 Peter 2:16. 2 Peter 2:16, where am I here? he's talking about, again, people that went off of the way, which have forsaken the right way. They're gone astray. So they were right, but they're no longer there. And these are warnings to Christians. They followed the way of Balaam, the son of Beor, who loved the wages of righteousness. So that's his error. And then he was rebuked for his iniquity. The dumb ass speaking with a man's voice forbade the madness of the prophet. So 2 Peter is calling him basically crazy. His donkey tried to reason with this crazy man, is what he's saying. This is a prophet that spoke and understood and knew God a few days earlier. And now we're all the way over here. So when the Bible references Balaam and it comes up like this, I would like in our minds a certain picture to come. When the Bible references Balaam, what warnings trigger? What alarm bells are we taking note of? So as he's saying of people who have forsaken, they were right. Again, we have to remember that. And that's the warning here. They were right, but are no longer. They have forsaken the way of Balaam. And with a donkey's voice forbade the madness of the prophet. Something entered into his brain, and he was mad. He was crazy, basically. It's 2 Peter's viewpoint on this incident. But he's still going. So Balak meets him. We're now here. Balak meets him. And His words are still sounding okay. He's still actually, he knows how to talk. Going back to the story. Where are we? So, and when Balak heard in verse 36, 22:36, and when Balak heard that Balaam was come, he went out to meet him into a city of Moab, which is in the border of Arnon, which is in the utmost coast. And Balak said unto Balaam, did I not earnestly send unto thee to call thee? Wherefore camest thou not unto me? Am I not able to indeed promote thee unto honor? And Balaam said unto Balak, lo, I am come unto thee. Have I now any power at all to say anything? The word that God putteth in my mouth, that shall I speak. So think of what the Bible just said about him, that he was mad, that his ways were perverse, that he entered from one state to a basically condemned state. And this is what's coming out of the man's mouth. Lo, I'm come unto thee. Have I now any power at all to say anything? The word that God puts in my mouth, that shall I speak. So think of the separation from what his mouth is saying to where the Bible clearly reveals his heart to be at. That's a shocking distance. That's a shocking distance. And Balaam went with Balak, and they came unto a long name. And Balak offered oxen and sheep and sent to Balaam and the princes that were with him. And it came to pass on the morrow that Balak took Balaam and brought him up into the high place of Baal, that he might see the utmost part of the people. And Balaam said unto Balak, build me here 7 altars. Balaam is ordering this. After all he's been through, he is initiating in enemy territory. He's initiating this. Balaam said unto Balaam, build me here 7 altars, prepare me here 7 oxen and 7 rams. And you have to wonder, what is he expecting? Like, what would he like or think God is going to do with 7 altars? Like, really, what was Balaam wanting? It's mind-boggling. Like, I can barely fathom this. And Balaam make the altars, and they made them. And they put a bull and a ram on each of them. And Balaam said unto Balak, stand by thy burnt offering, and I will go. Peradventure the Lord will come to meet me, and to whatsoever he showeth me, I will tell thee. He's still talking perfectly. Perfectly rational prophet talk. Being in an enemy country, wanting to curse God's people with the answers that he's been given. I keep repeating that, but this is so, so weird. And God met Balaam and said unto him, I have prepared 7 altars. I have offered upon every altar a bull and a ram. And the Lord put a word in Balaam's mouth and said, return to Balak, thus thou shalt speak. And he returned unto him, and he stood by his burnt sacrifice, he and all the princes of Moab. And then he's prophesying, how shall I curse whom God has not cursed? How shall I defy whom God has not defied? And then there's a blessing that he gives them. Who can count the dust of Jacob, the number of the fourth part of Israel? Let me die the right death of the righteous, and let my end be like his. And that quote is sometimes used, but if you look at the context of, again, where he's at, what he's doing, what he's saying, what he's trying to accomplish, he's still saying his words are, let me die the death of the righteous, let my end be like his, like Israel's. In other words, they'll be blessed, they'll be prosperous. And then Balak is mad, and it goes back and forth a few times. So he built the altars just in case God changes his mind. He gives every indication of playing along with Balak. He said, Balak, I'm trying. Let's push this. Let's work with it. Build the altars. We'll make it happen. Maybe God will work with us here. So his words are very, very deceptive, but his actions are clear. And that's something that as we look at life, as we look at our life, that we have to reckon with. Words can be one thing, but the actions and the heart can be very, very far removed. And God will look at the heart. In Joshua 24, Joshua 24:8. So Joshua 24, 8 to 10. God is saying here about this man, about his what God views it as. I brought you into the land of the Amorites. He's giving history of what he did with them, how he saved them. I brought you into the land of the Amorites, which dwelt on the other side of Jordan. And they fought with you, and I gave them into your hand, that you might possess their land. And I destroyed them from before you. Then Balak, the son of Zippor, the king of Moab, arose and warred against Israel, and sent and called Balaam, the son of Beor, to curse you. But I would not hearken unto Balaam. Therefore he blessed you still, so I delivered you out of his hand. And I found the wording here very interesting. God saying, I delivered Israel from Balaam. He didn't say he delivered them from Balak. Balak was the enemy. God said here literally, I delivered Israel in the same way that I delivered you from the other side of the Jordan, these people. God said, I delivered Israel from Balaam. That is a shocking thing to say. That Israel, or that Balaam, went from being God's prophet to God saying, I'm going to protect my people from you and you will not overcome them. It is such a awful thing. And God saying, I delivered you out of his hand. He meant to destroy you. But I stepped in, and he, like the other enemies of God, would not prevail. Then it just continues with the story. I went over Jordan, came into Jericho, and the journey continues. But Balaam has now went from a prophet of God to being one of God's enemies that were destroyed and overcome. And if you think back, where did this all start? What was the whole crux of the thing? The whole point is that this man, and the wording's in Jude, Peter, Revelation, the point is that they go against light. That is very, very, very serious, to go against light. So, again, Balaam's words were one thing, his actions were another. But if we look at what God says about him, it seems from the story as you read it, God kind of played along, but God did not play along. So the things that Balaam said when God, in that situation, instead of striking it with fire and lightning and killing him, God blessed them instead of cursing. It looks mild, but it's God's mercy doing that. God's heart was still, you're an enemy of God's people if you're in this spot. He should not have left home. He should not have asked the second time. He should not have asked the third time. He should have turned around when the donkey spoke to him. He should have turned around when the angel said, your ways are perverse. He should have turned around when he looked at them and saw them down there and said, build altars. Again and again and again and again, he's absolutely driving to what he wants, blindly, crazily. But something happened. But I think the main damage was done when he went against light the first time. I think this whole disaster started right there, which is very, very sobering. And he did not plan to be here, I guarantee you. When he was back in light of with God and talking to him, prophesying for God, he did not plan to be here. But he was, and he is. And God marks him through many different places in the Bible of what he did. But it started with one thing, that's going against light. So they try three times to see if God can be convinced to curse his people. So Balak can conquer God's people. And Balaam can get his money. God is obviously not going to do that. They try three times. It doesn't work. He blesses them a fourth time. It's almost like in a trance. And it's taken him further and further from his riches and power. And in verse 25, where are we? Verse 25. So here now they part. And Balak said unto Balaam, now this is nothing has worked. This is the disaster of a situation. He's long way from home. It's not worked. They're all frustrated. Balak said unto Balaam, neither curse them at all or bless them at all. Like just basically, I can't put it in the words that I'd like to, but just be quiet. Like don't do this. Don't curse them or bless them. Just shut up. So they're very frustrated with each other. He can't have his money. He can't have his curses. It's just a stalemate. And they're both just frustrated. It's just not working. And Balak said, just be quiet. Don't bless them or curse them. Like, give it up. And then Balaam answered and said unto Balak, And again, keep in mind what God is saying about this man. This is what his words are saying. Told not I thee, saying, all that the Lord speaketh, must I do. It's, again, I'm trying to bring out the disconnect of what the man's mouth is saying and probably what his mind is saying to him. I'm still a righteous man. I'm still clear before God. I'm not going to sin by cursing his people if he doesn't want me to. But that language is just off the wall, considering where his heart is at, what God says his heart is at. So he's still talking well. He's probably still thinking he's good. I'm not going to obviously sin and curse him if God doesn't want me to. So all that the Lord speaks, that must I do. It's not my fault that I'm not cursing. I'm trying to be righteous here, not go against God, is what he's saying. Having gone 10 times against what God wants. And God labels it as that. And then they go to another place. I had the wrong verse, 25. End of 24, the verse I wanted was this one. And Balaam rose up and went and returned to his place, and Balak also went his way. So at the end of all this, like I said before, they're both frustrated. It hasn't worked. They're both going home. The end. Kind of end of story. And it closes there with this incident. So, long, weird story. Animals talking. God seems to agree. Balaam is still talking right. Like, if you just look at the chapter of the story like that, it is what it is. But if you look at the Bible's point of view, then it's that. So here it's where it ends. They both go home, and that's that. And then what happened? There's more to the story. It's only about half done, actually. So in chapter 25, we'll just continue with God's narrative on this thing. And Israel abode in Shittim, and the people began to commit whoredom with the daughters of Moab. And they called the people and sacrificed of their gods, and the people did eat and bow down to their gods. And Israel joined himself to Baal Peor, and the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel. And the Lord said unto Moses, take all the heads of the people, hang them up before the Lord against the sun, that the fierce anger of the Lord may be turned away from Israel. Like, what on earth? They were just moving through. They just won a victory, going back here, before this incident interjected itself. They were winning. They went from that fiery pole incident. Then they asked to go through the land peaceably because they were doing right with God. They had a repentance, a revival. And they went forward and won a few battles. And the last battle we read is where they defeated Ammon with God's blessing. And then there's a pause in the story. Then Balaam happens. And the next thing we read about the corporate group is that they call the people of God through the sacrifices of the people began to commit whoredom with the daughters of Moab. So this is probably a week or two after the serpent incident, by the way. I'm just guessing in, but it's probably about 2 weeks after the serpent thing, where they had a revival, they got sobered up, there was judgment, and here we're back to that. And again, what happened? And going to Numbers 31, we do get commentary on what happened. So Numbers 31, 14 tells us what happened. And Moses said unto them, they were supposed to go out and deal with the enemies of God's people. Moses said to them, have you saved all the women alive? They're going out in, where am I here? And Moses was wroth with the officers of the host, with the captains over thousands, captain over hundreds, which came from the battle. He said unto them, have you saved all the women alive? Behold, these caused the children of Israel, through the counsel of Balaam, to commit trespass against the Lord in the matter of Peor. And there was a plague in the congregation of the Lord. Now therefore, kill every male among the little ones, and kill every woman that hath known the men by lying with him. And it goes through the different things that they had to do to clean the situation out morally. But the point here is that Balaam went into the Moabite camp and taught them how to deceive and pollute, if I can say it that way, and cause them to commit gross sin before the Lord. Balaam taught them that. Think of this as a prophet of God. It says here that Balaam caused them, he taught them through the counsel of Balaam to commit trespass against the Lord. Here's how we're going to get the Israelites. We can't curse them, but he went into the camp, literally taught the enemy how to get in here, where their weaknesses are, how to infiltrate, go slowly, go easily, do this, do that. By their counsel, they got in, and there were 24,000 people that died because of that, I believe. So this man is not finished. And again, keep in mind that he was a prophet of God a few weeks ago. I guess this would have taken time, so months maybe. And 24,000 died through the counsel of Balaam. These women, on purpose, caused Israelites to sin against God. And now these women are getting judged because of what they did. It's awful. And in Revelations 2, another place that talks about Balaam, his name comes up so many times. So Revelations 2, 2:14. But I have a few things against thee. Thou hast there that hold them the doctrine of Balaam, who taught Balak to cast a stumbling block before the children of Israel, and to eat things sacrificed to idols and to commit fornication. So Balaam did that. On purpose, planned, Balaam did it. And he's saying somehow in this New Testament age that he's saying there's that error of causing God's people to stumble is still here. And I didn't mind that out yet. It'd be an interesting study how that applies to us now, but it's here. When God said, I have a few things against you. So to keep God's children on the path without being deceived off of it or being beguiled off of the path, it'd be a serious thing. It'd be a good study. So it's almost unbelievable. When you think of his beginning, how did he get there? Again, he went against light the first time. So it's not something to be played with. There are consequences. So in Numbers 26, there's a rebellion that happened. A plague came as judgment. And again, 24,000 died over one man's actions. It's awful. In Numbers 31, what happened? What happened to him? So in Numbers 31, it does say what happened to him. Numbers 31:8. They had war, and they warred against the Midianites, as the Lord commanded Moses. They slew all the males. They slew the kings of Midian. Beside the rest of them, they were slain named Evi, Rechem, Zur, Hur, Reba. These are the enemies of the Israelites, enemies of God. The five kings of Midian. And then in this list of enemies, Balaam, also the son of Beor, they slew with the sword. So Balaam was in the enemy camp fighting with enemy kings against Israel, God's prophet. He's there. That's how he died. They also slew him, and the story simply moves on. He's just listed as part of the list of God's enemies, the end dismissed for what he could have been. Like, had he had a different response, had money not deceived him and deluded him. And in Joshua 13, just one more. So Joshua 13:22. Just one more thing about this unfortunate man. 13:22. All the cities of the plain, all the kingdom of Sihon, the king of the Amorites, which reigned in Heshbon. It's going through their chronicle of what they conquered. Which Moses smote with the prince of Midian, Evi, Rechem, Zur, Hur, Reba, which were the dukes of Sihon dwelling in the country, Balaam, the son of Beor, the soothsayer, that the children of Israel slain, with the sword among them that were slain by them. And again, the story just continues. He's just almost a statistic at that point. He's just a name with the list of God's enemies. And that's the end of Balaam. It's a shocking story. But again, as you read it, it's hard to get that out. But if you look at the Bible's rest of the commentary, it's very clear what this man did. So one more note. Often we can say, what a mess, what an absolute disaster. But if you would look at all of that, what did God have in mind? And sometimes it can be so simple, but the whole matter started how? Who remembers? How did this start, this whole disaster? They simply wanted to pass through a land. Israel sent messages unto Sihon, king of the Amorites, saying, let me pass through their land. We'll not turn into the fields, into the vineyards. We'll not drink of the waters of the well, but we'll go along the king's highway until we pass by thy borders. That was the initial request that actually started this whole process. And then that led to a war, which led to a region being taken over. And that region was next to the Moabites. It was their border country. And now the Israelites were occupying that. Amnon, or Moab, was terrified, and he said, these people are just taken over like grasshoppers. What do we do? Initiate the Balaam story. But the whole thing had, this king said, you know what, that's reasonable. Go through my land. Be blessed. This would all not be here. Now, I'm not saying it's his fault. My point is just to say that, actions matter. An ordinary decision can be catastrophic. It's been, some of the world wars have started with very obscure incidents that shouldn't have been anything, but they were. First World War especially. It just, one thing led to another, which led to another, which led to another, which cost millions of people their life from a seemingly insignificant incident that people didn't know would do that. And what that is in my life and your life, I don't know, but the caution is to walk carefully, clearly with God, with God's heart. So again, just to close up here, Balaam talked well. That's pretty clear. He did talk well, but his actions revealed his heart. And the Bible revealed what was in there when God put light on it. So let's be careful to walk in light. Don't play with God. Don't push God. Respect him. When he says no, it's no. Let's not put our human endeavor and will and wants when God speaks. So let's walk as close to the will of God as possible instead of what we can get away with. And the warnings that are given in Peter, Jude, Revelations, they are in this manner. It says walk carefully so you don't go the way of Balaam. That's not an idle thing. So he's not saying it for nothing. And this is an extreme example, but it's saying this is where it starts. Walk carefully. Walk rightly with God. When God says no, it's no. Don't push. So the core things here are that money is deceptive and to respect and love God. So in John 8, one thing I was thinking of, do we then fear and quake at God because of these catastrophic things that can happen if I can say this, if he's crossed? That's not the thing. I think this was as severe as it was because Balaam tried to play with God. He tried to manipulate him, push. There was a lot of disrespect in here, a lot of disrespect. So in John 8, I'd like to go there just for a balancing thing. You might not, I hope you get how it fits. But the woman caught in adultery, when these men brought her, it says in the very act, to Jesus. I think it's John 8. Why am I not seeing it? Oh, right, yeah. Okay, so John 8, I'd like to read that. The scribes and Pharisees brought unto him a woman taken in adultery. When they had set her in the midst, they said unto him, Master, this woman is taken in adultery, the very act. So if you look at their language is similar to Balaam's. It's righteous, it looks right. But God has a way of just cutting to what's true. And I've said this many times, or Jesus does. He just goes right to the absolute heart of it and lays it open. So their words are this, Master, this woman was taken in adultery in the very act. But they were just playing with him. They were just trying to manipulate God. And God would have none of that. He's not to be played with. And they said unto him, Master, this woman was taken in adultery in the very act. Moses and the law commanded that such should be stoned. What sayest thou? Trying to trick him, trying to set him up, trying to manipulate him. This they said, tempting him, that they might have to accuse him. But Jesus stooped down with his finger and wrote on the ground, as though he heard them not. So we don't know what he read or what he wrote, but some are speculating he might have written one of their names and an incident that happened a month ago and just a few clues about it. A red tent, or I don't know, that somebody would clue in what? And his brain starts going, and he knows about that. And the oldest one shuffled off, and then the next oldest one, and Jesus kept writing. He didn't respond. He's just stooped down and wrote. And they which heard it, being convicted, as though he heard them not. And when they continued asking him, they were just pushing at him, he lifted up himself and said unto them, he that is without sin among you, let him cast the first cast a stone at her. And again, he stooped down and wrote on the ground. This is such a, what's he doing? What he's doing is he's cutting to the heart and dealing with what's actually going on. You are not going to play with me. I know what you did. 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 I know you're trying to take this woman who did wrong, but you want to make her so you can be proud of what you are doing. You're all as guilty as she is, and you're trying to play with God here. And God said, not a chance. We're not playing that game. You all are more guilty than she is. And when that whole thing was finished, he dismissed them and dealt with them. I'm just saying that God sees the heart. He dealt with them. Then he stood up. And again, keep in mind, this woman had committed adultery. And they all left, one by one. Sorry, I'll just read that. And when they heard it being convicted at their own conscience, they went out, one by one, beginning at the eldest to the last. And Jesus was left alone, and the woman standing in the midst. When Jesus had lifted up himself, now he's standing up, and saw none but the woman, he said unto her, woman, where are those thine accusers? Hath no man condemned thee? And she said, I like this response, no man, Lord. There's no human left to judge me. But you are Lord, I get that. You are Lord, you could do it. There's no man left, but you legitimately could accuse me, Lord. And Jesus said unto her, neither do I condemn thee, go and sin no more. And again, thinking of what he did with the Pharisees, absolute, he dealt with them solidly, truly, because their heart was what it was. He exposed it, dismissed it. Don't play with me. We don't do this game. You're not going to use this woman to do that. And then he looks at her who had committed adultery and saw her heart. She called him Lord. I believe her heart was broken, humble. I don't know how she got there, but he forgave her and gave her life. And that is the heart of God. So it's not that we fear him and that we're terrified of what will happen, but the heart is to do what he wants and walk with how he wants us to walk, respect him, walk in light. And he's more than willing to work with us, but he's not going to be played with. So that's what I take out of Balaam. It's a very, very sobering story, especially in light of the other verses where it talks of moving from a good place to a bad place. God's people, the warnings in the other part of our, but God's people moving from a lit place to a dark place like he did. So he was the extreme example, but the fact that the Bible points to it and saying, don't be like that. We need to look at what he did, how he got there. And that starts with the things in our life that would potentially do that. So let's pray. God, we want to come to you again. Thank you that your warnings are there, that you can take things that are negative and show us how to walk carefully with you, loving you. May our heart be your heart. May we say yes, Father, and not push, and honor what you honor and love what you love. God, make us children of light more and more. May that be the mark of this church, this group, these people, us, that we are your children. We honor you. We respect you. We don't play with you. We do what you want because we love you. Give that to us, God, as a gift, hearts that will draw unto you and towards you. I pray for that, Lord. Be with us. Thank you for this day. Commit ourselves in your care in Jesus' name. Amen.